Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I would like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Michael Uden.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michael Uden. I am the Acting Assistant Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education here at the department, and I'm happy to welcome you to our third webinar on ESEA flexibility. The audio and PowerPoint presentations for our first two webinars are now available on our website. The first webinar provided an overview of ESEA flexibility, and the second provided a closer look at preparing the SEA request. You can link to the flexibility webpage from the department homepage at eded.gov. The webinars and other useful information for states are provided on the Support for States page. We will continue to update these webpages to provide new material and information. During today's webinar, we will be providing answers to commonly asked questions that we have received. During the second half of the hour, we will be answering your questions live. You should also be aware that an additional document is available on our website, the ESEA Frequently Asked Questions document. We will continue to update this document to add new questions and answers. But before we begin today, I would like to reiterate some key points about the process going forward. We have developed ESEA flexibility to support a new partnership with states and districts willing to move forward with key reforms while holding firm on accountability. The department commits to support and partner with states that are willing to take on this challenge, and I commit the resources of the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education to help support this partnership. The department will be helping with the nuts and bolts, giving states assistance to submit an approvable request. And we want to help you think through big ideas and comprehensive reforms that will support great teaching and help all students achieve success. In response to your feedback, we are planning a series of additional webinars in the coming weeks. So you should know that there is not one right way nor one right timeline for requesting flexibility. We view these principles that are identified in the documents as components of a comprehensive accountability system. We expect you to address these principles, but there's flexibility for you to determine how you meet these principles. And of course, we want you to be innovative and thoughtful as you develop your comprehensive strategies. We recognize this is not easy work. Some states are ready to get started immediately, and as you know, those states have an opportunity to submit in November. Other states will need time to further develop and put the foundations in place for reform. And we will support those states as well and give them multiple chances to submit requests and receive ongoing assistance in the near future as necessary. When considering when to apply, states should know this is not a competition. There will not be winners and losers. We want to be able to say yes to any state that demonstrates that it is serious about reform and willing to put in the work. State flexibility requests will be reviewed by a team of peers, and their evaluations will help inform the Secretary's decision-making. And for states that might need some more work up front, we will continue to work with you to get you to the finish line. Reviewers and the department will provide feedback, technical assistance, and additional opportunities for states to resubmit requests for peer review throughout the winter and into the spring if necessary. And even once the state is approved, the process isn't over. There will be an ongoing partnership to review the success of implementation, to ensure all students continue to be served, and to transfer best practices to other states. Throughout this process, if you have a question or would like to schedule a time for your team to speak with department staff, please email us at ESEAflexibility, that's one word, ESEAflexibility@ed.gov. We welcome the opportunity to speak with you and we will respond to all questions as quickly as we can. If you have not already done so, please send the name of your state contact for ESEA Flexibility to that mailbox. We want to make sure that we are keeping your team in the loop on all webinars, new resources, and other critical information throughout this process. I want to emphasize again that we view our role as a department and at the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education as your partners. We want to be responsive and helpful throughout this process, so please let us know how we can help. We look forward to working with you over the coming weeks and months. At this point, I'd like to turn this over to a few members of the ESEA Flexibility team who will be answering your questions today. You will hear from Sharon Hall, Victoria Hammer, Pat Johnson, Scott Sawgrad, and other members of our team. So I'm going to be handing it over to Victoria, who will be starting us off. Victoria?
Thank you, Michael. We will now address some of the most commonly asked questions we have received to date before opening this up to you to ask additional questions you may have. A number of questions have asked whether an SEA that receives ESEA flexibility is still required to make AYP determinations as it does under NCLB. The answer to that question is yes. Question B11 in the Frequently Asked Question document addresses this question, and we encourage you to review that question and answer carefully. We also want to point out that although the rules for AYP determinations continue to apply, there are two key changes with respect to AYP. First, as we discussed during the last webinar, an SEA has new options through ESEA flexibility for how it will set its AMOs. After an SEA receives ESEA flexibility, these new AMOs will form the basis for a state's AYP determinations. Because we discussed the options for how an SEA can set its new AMOs during the last webinar, we will not review that flexibility now, but we'd be happy to answer additional questions you may have about setting your new AMOs. As Michael said, you'll have an opportunity to raise additional questions when we open the lines at the end of this webinar, and you can always submit a question to eseaflexibility@ed.gov. What we will discuss today is the other significant change that ESEA flexibility makes to AYP, and that is a change in how AYP determinations are actually used. So what is the difference? What is different about how AYP determinations are used by an SEA that receives ESEA flexibility? The biggest change is that AYP determinations will no longer be used to identify Title I schools for improvement, corrective action, or restructuring. Instead, AYP determinations will be used primarily for reporting purposes. That is, just as they are under current law, AYP determinations will be reported on state and district report cards. Beyond that primary purpose, AYP determinations will be used to inform but will not be the sole factor in accountability. In an SEA's new system of differentiated recognition, accountability, and support under ESEA flexibility, AYP determinations are simply one factor that an SEA takes into account to identify Title I schools that are not priority or focus schools but that have specific needs for academic support and improvement. An SEA can also use AYP determinations to assess the needs of those schools and the supports to be provided in each school. Other factors that might be considered along with AYP determinations include the change in school or subgroup performance over time, other indicators of student achievement such as enrollment in AP or IB courses or student portfolios, indicators of school climate, or any other factor that might be a part of an existing state system of recognition, accountability, and support. Question C18 in the FAQs discusses how AYP can inform accountability under ESEA flexibility, and we encourage you to review that question and answer for additional information on this issue. So, how AYP determinations are used will change, but how will AYP remain the same under ESEA flexibility? Well, SEAs will continue to have the same flexibility they have under current law with respect to how they make AYP determinations. For example, an SEA will still have the flexibility to include in AYP determinations the proficient scores of students with disabilities who take an alternate assessment based on alternate academic achievement standards up to the 1% cap. An SEA will also retain the flexibility to include for up to 2 years, the scores of former English learners and former students with disabilities in determining AYP for those subgroups. Similarly, an SEA will still have the flexibility to choose not to include the scores of recently arrived English learners on the state's mathematics assessment or its reading language arts assessment if they take that test. The requirements for making and reporting AYP determinations also still apply under ESEA flexibility. For example, an SEA will still be required to determine whether a school or district makes AYP based on the disaggregated results for each student subgroup on the state's reading language arts and math assessments. The AYP requirements regarding the other academic indicator and participation rate will also continue to apply. When thinking about the other academic indicator, remember that ESCA flexibility does not waive the regulatory requirements for graduation rates. In addition, a school will continue to be able to make AYP through Safe Harbor even if one or more subgroups miss its new proficiency targets, just as it can under current law. Because states now have much more flexibility with respect to how they set AMOs, schools may not need to rely on Safe Harbor as much as they do under current law, but this option will remain available. Finally, as I stated earlier, AYP determinations will still have to be included on state and district report cards, just as they currently are. Sharon will now walk us through some questions we have received about priority and focus schools.
Thank you, Victoria. We have received several questions from states regarding how a state must identify its priority and focus schools. An SEA requesting this flexibility must identify priority and focus schools. The definition of these terms is set forth in the document titled ESEA Flexibility. In general, a priority school is a school that is among the lowest performing schools in the state based on statewide assessments or graduation rate and lack of progress, and a focus school is a school with the largest achievement gaps, low achievement for one or more subgroups, or a low graduation rate. An SEA must identify a number of schools equal to at least 5% of its Title I schools as priority schools, and an additional number of schools equal to at least 10% of its Title I schools as focus schools. An SEA may not identify the same schools as both a priority and focus school. An SEA must submit its list of priority and focus schools based on the most recent data available, which will likely be data from the 10-11 school year for most states as part of its request for flexibility. An SEA and its LEAs must also include the identification of priority schools and focus schools in their annual report cards, beginning with report cards for the 2011-2012 school year. An SEA will have the flexibility to update its list of priority and focus schools as new data become available, but will not be required to do so. I'd like to note that focus and priority schools have different timelines for interventions because of the different interventions expected. An SEA must ensure that all focus schools implement interventions beginning in the 2012-13 school year. For priority schools, the bottom 5%, an SEA must provide a timeline to ensure that LEAs with priority schools implement interventions aligned with the turnaround principles in each priority school no later than the 2014-15 school year. The document titled ESEA Flexibility Frequently Asked Questions includes several questions and answers that are related to this issue. See, in particular, C-22 through C-30. An additional question we have received on priority and focus schools is how to identify high schools with graduation rates less than 60% over a number of years as priority and focus schools. Title I participating high schools with graduation rates less than 60% over a number of years must be identified as either priority or focus schools. In addition, Title I eligible high schools with low graduation rates may be identified as priority schools, but not as focus schools. How does implementation of the ESEA flexibility interact with an SEA's or LEA's implementation of the School Improvement Grant or SIG program? The implementation of the ESEA flexibility interacts with an SEA's or LEA's implementation of the SIG program in several ways. First, in developing its list of priority schools, an SEA may count a persistently lowest achieving school or PLA school that is using SIG funds toward the number of priority schools it must identify under this flexibility. For example, an SEA might have 25 priority schools and already be serving 10 PLA schools under SIG. the SEA can choose to count any of those 10 PLA schools toward the 25 total priority schools it would need to identify. The second area SIG and ESEA flexibility interact is with regards to the use of SIG funds. Currently, an SEA may award SIG funds to an LEA that applies to implement one of the four SIG models in a PLA school. If an SEA receives this flexibility, the SEA will also be able to award SIG funds to priority schools to implement one of the SIG models, even if those schools are not PLA schools. Consistent with the requirements of the SIG program, an SEA must continue to award these funds through a competitive process. And finally, an LEA that is awarded SIG funds must use those SIG funds in accordance with the requirement of the SIG program, even if the funds are awarded to serve a priority school that is not a PLA school. Victoria will now walk us through some questions about SES and school choice.
Thank you, Sharon. Several questions have been asked regarding the SEA and LEA requirements related to Supplemental Educational Services, or SES, and school choice for an SEA approved for ESEA flexibility. Under this flexibility, an LEA would no longer be required to comply with the requirements in ESEA Section 1116B to identify for improvement, corrective action, or restructuring as appropriate its Title I schools that fail for two consecutive years or more to make AYP, and neither the LEA nor its schools would be required to take currently required improvement actions. However, an SEA may still require or permit an LEA to take such actions. In other words, an LEA in a state that receives this flexibility would no longer be required to offer SES or choice-related transportation under federal law or reserve the requisite amount of funds for these activities. However, the provision of SES and choice-related transportation remain allowable uses of Title I Part A funds. Therefore, an SEA could include SES or choice-related transportation as part of its new differentiated recognition, accountability, and support system, or an LEA could continue to use these funds to offer SES or choice-related transportation as long as these services are not inconsistent with the SEA's new system. Although an LEA is not required to spend the funds freed up through this flexibility on particular activities, LEAs must ensure sufficient support for implementation of interventions in priority schools, focus schools, and other Title I schools identified under the SEA's Differentiated Recognition, Accountability, and Support System. The document titled ESEA Flexibility Frequently Asked Questions includes several questions and answers that are related to this issue. See, in particular, B9 and B10. What are an SEA's requirements related to SES and school choice before ESEA flexibility is received? Until an SEA is approved to implement the flexibility, it must continue to comply with the current requirements related to approving SES providers. However, an SEA may consider changes to its practices as it determines if and when it intends to request for the flexibility. For example, if an SEA intends to request for the flexibility in November, and it normally conducts its process of approving SES providers in January, it may consider moving its process later. But in any case, an SEA that has not received flexibility must be able to meet the current requirements. If an SEA requests and is approved for the flexibility prior to when it would have normally gone through its process for approving SES providers, it would not need to do so. Some states have asked if an SEA that is approved for ESEA flexibility will still be required to implement a statewide system of support as required in Section 1117 of the ESEA. The answer to that question is yes. Because this requirement is not waived, is not part of ESEA flexibility, SEAs will still be required to implement a statewide system of support. However, how this statewide system of support operates may change from past practices based on the proposed differentiated accountability system plan presented in the FDA's request. At this point, I will turn this over to Pat, who will talk about highly qualified teacher requirements and other topics.
Thank you, Victoria. Here is our question. Do LEAs that did not previously meet highly qualified teacher targets based on 2010-11 and prior school year data still have to develop improvement plans under this flexibility? For states that are approved for this flexibility, an LEA is not required to develop an improvement plan or have the use of its funds restricted pursuant to such a plan, regardless of the years for which it did not meet HQT targets. An SEA will be able to take advantage of this flexibility as soon as its request is approved. For example, if as an SEA is approved in January of 2012, it would be able to implement this particular flexibility at that time. Until the date that the request is approved, SEAs and LEAs must comply with all current laws. Now I will turn this back to Sharon.
Thanks, Pat. Some states have asked about the date by which an SEA approved to implement the flexibility must update its accountability workbook. Any SEA that submits a request for flexibility may delay submitting its amended accountability workbook until after its request is approved. The department will work with SEAs to enable them to expeditiously update their accountability workbooks prior to the 2012-2013 school year. An SEA with an approved request may begin implementing the flexibility before its amendments to its accountability workbook are approved. Okay, now some states have asked about our desire that states indicate their intent to request the flexibility by October 12th. The intent to request email to the ESEA flexibility at ed.gov mailbox should indicate the specific window for which an SEA anticipates submitting its request. For instance, a state should note whether it expects to submit a request in November or February. The intent to request email is not binding. It's simply a tool to help Ed plan for the review. An SEA is always free to select another window at a later point. Just please let us know if a change is made. Ed will post a list of the states that submit an intent to submit email and the review window for which the state anticipates submitting its request. Ed will update this list as needed. And some SEAs have asked about the November 14th submission date. An SEA may submit a request anytime on November 14th in order to be considered in the first review window. There is no time certain by which requests must be submitted on November 14th. Requests are to be submitted to our designated mailbox, ESEA Flexibility at ed.gov. Now, if you should have any technical problems with your submission, please email me, Sharon Hall, at sharon.hall@ed.gov, and I'll provide you with the next step. We're now going to turn this over to your questions. You may either ask questions through the operator or the chat function. We may not be able to answer all of your questions live today. If we do not answer your questions today, please submit them to ESEAflexibility@ed.gov and you will receive a response.
Thank you. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment for our first question. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1.
We've gotten one question from the chat function, and Ann Ellison has asked, what is a PLA school? A PLA school is a persistently lowest achieving school under the SIG program, and these are schools that are either Title I schools that are in the lowest 5% of schools in the state that are in improvement, corrective action, or restructuring, or have a graduation rate below 60% over a number of years. Or they can be Title I eligible high schools who are also in the lowest performing 5% of schools in corrective action, improvement, corrective action, or restructuring, or have a graduation rate below 60% over a number of years.
Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from Veronica Tate. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Veronica Tate in Virginia, and I just want to ask a clarifying question regarding the list of focus and priority schools that are to be submitted with state applications. So Virginia intends to submit an application with the February deadline, and we will be putting our list together based on the most recently available data. And if I heard correctly, we can identify a new list when we administer assessments this coming spring. And I ask that question because it stands to reason that we'll need to identify the list of focus and priority schools for the 2012-13 year based on implementing new AMOs this coming spring 2012. So I just want to make sure that I understood that correctly.
Thanks for that question. Yes, you would be able to update your list of priority and focus schools based on assessment data from the most recent school year. So once you have come in with your request, with your list of schools based on 10-11 data, you could then update that list based on 11-12 data. You would have to come in, again, with a plan to implement interventions in your priority schools over the course of the period of the flexibility. Mm-hmm. So if you did update your list, you would have to consider how that interacts with your timeline for implementing interventions.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
So we've had a question come in the chat function.
Right.
And the question is, when identifying schools as priority or focus, are they only Title I schools, not Title I eligible as with SIG? And the answer to that is, for priority schools, you can identify Title I participating schools that have the lowest achievement in the state, and both Title I participating and Title I eligible high schools with graduation rate below 60% over a number of years. For focus schools, the definition only includes Title I participating schools, whether they're elementary schools, middle schools, or high schools.
Our next question comes from Robin Lisboa. Your line is open.
Yes, it's just a short question. Do we know what implications a state's waiver request has for Title III AMAOs?
Yes, so your new AMOs that would be set through the flexibility would replace AMAO 3, which is AYP for the English learner subgroup. The other AMAOs, the proficiency and progress for English learners attaining English language proficiency, would remain the same. And there are no waivers in this flexibility for Title III requirements.
Thank you.
Am I off mute?
Yeah.
Oh.
Our next question comes from Elizabeth Bolden. Your line is open.
Thank you. Could you please tell me if a state has to participate in one of the assessment consortiums in order to be considered eligible for ESEA flexibility?
No, a state does not have to participate in one of the Race to the Top assessment consortia. A state has to demonstrate that it will adopt high-quality assessments consistent with the definition in the flexibility document, but it could do that either through joining one of the consortia or adopting other high-quality assessments that are aligned to its college and career-ready standards.
And, sir, we have no further questions at this time.
We had a question come in through the chat function about the 2141C plans and the highly qualified teacher requirements. And the question was, what happens to those LEAs that were put on the 2141C plans for the 2010-2011 school year and don't meet 100% HQT and or AYP for the 2011-2012 school year? So for those LEAs, as soon as the state is approved for the flexibility, the LEAs and the state would not have to develop or implement any improvement plans, and the SDA would not have to hold back funds pursuant to those plans. Prior to being approved for the flexibility, the state and its LEAs would still have to carry out any requirements under the current law, including implementing improvement plans and withholding funds if appropriate.
Sir?
Yes.
We do show that we have another question. The guest has not recorded their name. Your line is open, guest.
Yes, thank you. Tom Kimbrell from Arkansas. The question is, what is anticipated time frame for the approval of the waiver request in February?
So we think that for the waiver request in February, we would likely try to get approvals in the late spring, possibly in late April, early May. And it depends on whether states need additional technical assistance after they come in for their first request. But we hope to be able to turn those around fairly quickly.
And give you enough time to make the changes that you need to make to impact the following school year.
We had another question.
I'm sorry, sir. I was going to announce the next question. Go ahead.
Okay. I just was going to take a question that came from the chat. There's a question about the connection between AMOs and the identification of priority and focus schools, and would a priority or focus school necessarily fail to meet the state's new AMOs for consecutive years to be identified? And the answer to that is no. The new AMOs would not be used to identify priority and focus schools. The priority and focus schools would be identified just based on their level of achievement or their graduation rates. The new AMOs could be used as part of the state's broader differentiated accountability system to identify other schools that need supports or interventions, but they would not be used to identify priority or focus schools.
Our next question does come from Neen Moloch. Your line is open.
What about states who were waiting to submit their accountability workbook for the incorporation of the new graduation rate? Will the delay in the submission of the accountability workbook affect our implementation for the 11-12 school year?
That's a really good question. I think we're going to have to probably talk a little bit more with you offline and get back to you. Would you be able to submit that question to our mailbox, and then we can follow up?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes.
We'll submit the answer. The question, excuse me.
Is this Jeopardy? Great, thank you.
Our next question comes from Veronica Tate. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking a second question. This is about the requirement to identify priority schools for a three-year timeline. I believe I heard in the forum last week that states can determine the criteria by which those schools would exit the priority list, and I just wanted to ask a clarifying question regarding the actual timeline. For example, if there are schools that are eligible to exit after or before the three-year time frame is up, is that allowable?
So once the school has begun implementing its interventions, it would have to continue to implement those interventions for 3 years, regardless of whether it exits priority status. If a school makes enough improvement to exit priority status consistent with the state's criteria before it starts implementing an intervention, it wouldn't have to implement the intervention.
If it begun implementing the intervention and became eligible based on the criteria to actually not be labeled a priority school anymore, is that allowable? In other words, they would continue the timeline for implementation and continue implementing the requirements of the intervention. However, they would not necessarily be labeled a priority school.
Yes, that would be fine. They could no longer be labeled a priority school as long as they continue to fully implement the intervention.
Great. Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
We had another question come in from the chat. Does a state need a fully approved assessment system to be eligible to apply for the ESEA flexibility? And the answer to that is no. A state does not have to have a fully approved assessment system in order to be eligible. And we just had another question come in from the chat. In determining priority and focus schools, do we use the same formula utilized in the SIG grants? And generally, yes, the identification of priority schools is similar to how you would identify schools under SIG. The main difference is the pool of schools that you would identify from is larger under the priority schools. Priority schools can be any Title I participating school. However, under SIG, it was only the Title I schools that were in improvement, corrective action, or restructuring. But generally, the way you would identify the schools is the same. And focus schools are different. The formula for identifying focus schools is based on the largest achievement gaps, the lowest performing subgroups, or low graduation rates. So those are very different from schools under SIG.
Sir, I show no further questions at this time.
We had a question come in from the chat that asks, can you talk about how or whether states might incentivize performance that is above the proficient level in establishing AMOs? So states have an even flexibility in setting their AMOs, and in addition, states need to identify reward schools, which are those schools that are either the highest achieving schools in the state or the schools making the most progress. And the way that a state might provide recognition or rewards to those schools could be important in incentivizing performance above the proficient level or showing high levels of improvement in student achievement. We also had a question come in on the chat. What happens if an SEA requests or receives flexibility, does not create an approved SES provider list, yet has LEAs that want to use school choice or SES? And that's a question that we've been thinking about, and we'll have to do some more thinking on that and get back to you. And we'll put some more guidance up on exactly what states' responsibilities are with regards to providers if they do receive the flexibility. We had a question on the chat asking if this presentation will be available for download as a hard copy so you can share it with staff who were not able to attend. And yes, this presentation will be posted on our website in the same place as all of our other presentations on the ESEA Flexibility website on ed.gov. And the audio will also be posted on the website.
Thank you for all of your questions this afternoon. A few of you have posed some questions via the chat function that actually we need to discuss a little bit more to provide you with an answer. So we will make sure to do that. We have your names, we have the questions, and we will email you an answer to those questions. Further, if you have other questions as you're thinking on this webinar today and as you're working to prepare your request, please submit them to ESEAflexibility@ed.gov, and we will get back to you as quickly as we can. So we're also scheduling office hours for SEA teams. And actually earlier today, Patricia McKee sent out an email to state contacts and Title I directors regarding some directions for scheduling your conversation with department staff during those office hours. If you would like to schedule a time for your team to speak with the department staff, please email us using the ESEA Flexibility mailbox. Thank you all for joining us today. We look forward to continue working with you. Did you have any additional final questions coming in?
Yes, ma'am. I had one last question. The guest did not record their name. Guest, you do have an open line now.
Hello. This is Barbara Gantwork. And my question was, in one of the Q&As, the question was, when will schools begin to use this new flexibility? And the answer suggests that schools might begin to feel the impact in the current school year. And I was wondering how you saw what impact could be felt this year for a state that, let's say, submitted early and received approval for their waiver.
So there are a couple of things that might start happening in the 11-12 school year. One is, as I think we mentioned earlier, the waiver around HQT improvement plans. That waiver would take effect immediately once a state is approved for the flexibility, and so LEAs would no longer have to implement their improvement plans for the 2011-2012 school year. Also, when the state is approved, they will have their new AMOs, which they can use for AYP determinations for assessments administered in the 11-12 school year.
At this time, we do not show any more audio questions.
Well, thank you again for joining us today. Once again, a few questions remain unanswered, and we'll get back to you. We appreciate your participation in this webinar very much.
This does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.